Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
Hey Off Besties, Happy New Year. We're kicking off 2025 here at Something Offbeat by looking back at 2024 and checking in on some of our favorite stories, from futuristic brain chip technology to the ancient secrets of Stonehenge. And these are just a little taste of all the strange tales we explored this year. Let's start off with our dive into Elon Musk's project Neuralink. Patients with quadriplegia have had chips implanted into their brains, opening up a new ability to use computers with their brain. It's a miracle for these patients, but where is this technology headed? L. Sid M. Johnson, Associate Professor of Bioethics and Humanities at SUNY Upstate Medical University, and science journalist Faye Flam joined the show to discuss.
I'm your host, Mike Rogers. This is Something Off Beats. First up, we've got Dr. Johnson.
Brain implants, it's all something that I know for a lot of people, it sounds really, really scary. Is it? Should we be scared?
I think we should be, actually, given who is doing the research on this. Now, there has been research on brain implants of various types. Since the 1970s, brain-computer interface research has been ongoing since then. And a lot of these experiments involve wearable devices and sometimes with implantable devices as well. There are currently only a few dozen living people in the world who have implanted devices, right? And they're all currently experimental. But the research that's been done, you know, allows a user to control an external device like a robotic arm. Some of the research involves just taking electrical signals from someone's scalp, and those are, you know, very safe and non-invasive for those users. My concerns about the Neuralink implant is what they intend to do with it, but also sort of their poor track record so far with research, and then all of the hype and the overpromising that they're doing about what these devices will be able to do.
Another advancement in tech that made headlines last year came from Loyal, a biotech company aiming to extend dogs' lives. We interviewed Dr. Brennan McKenzie of Loyal about the project.
Brennan, tell me a little bit about Loyal.
So Loyal is a biotechnology company. We're based in the Bay Area in San Francisco. And our goal is to develop medications through the FDA approval process, so prescription drugs that extend healthy lifespan in dogs. So people can have more time with their dogs and their dogs can feel good during that time.
This sounds like something the dog owners have probably been dreaming of for years. How did the idea come about?
So the credit all goes to our CEO, Celine Haliua. As she tells the story, you know, early on in her life, was disappointed at the realization that, you know, medicine can't solve every problem, that a lot of age-associated diseases are really challenging to treat, and that maybe prevention would be a more effective strategy. And so she got interested in the idea of targeting some of the underlying processes of aging in order to try to prevent the bad health outcomes that a lot of us and our pets experience as we get older. You know, we tend to think of aging as this inevitable, immutable fact of the universe. But the reality is aging is just biology. It's just a set of things that happen in the body like any other health issue. And if we can study it and understand it, no reason why we can't develop therapies to improve outcomes.
Our next destination is outer space with Dr. Avi Loeb from Harvard. During Loeb's second appearance on the show, he helped us break down alleged UFO sightings and updated us on the latest in his search for extraterrestrial life.
After two images of UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, UFOs, if you wish, were released back in January. Now, these images were captured in the Middle East, which is a place that Loeb says pretty hard to know for sure what different militaries are doing.
The government is always giving us anecdotal reports of, you know, military personnel that happen to be at the right place at the right time. And you never know how unusual is what you're seeing relative to things that happen in that environment all the time. And so in the Galileo project, instead of relying on anecdotal evidence, we are monitoring the sky all the time. And we look at the entire sky. And this way, we can calibrate how unusual an object is relative to the background. And the second problem with the military reports is that we don't have any way to go back and check what the instrument was doing and how reliable is the data that we get. And so with the Galileo project, we are calibrating our instruments. We looked already over the past few months at hundreds of thousands of objects, and we have machine learning software that is being educated, being trained on known birds and airplanes and drones and balloons. And that's how we want to filter out those anomalous ones. And those jellyfish images indeed looked anomalous, but we really need better data.
Loeb launched the Galileo project back in 2021 to search for extraterrestrial intelligence, unexplained aircraft, and UAPs, among other things. Talk about the Galileo project for a moment. Does artificial intelligence play into this now?
Definitely. I mean, we know from FIFA, the soccer organization, when there was the Women's World Cup in summer 2023, and there was doubt about whether the ball crossed the line of the goal, they didn't go around and ask the players or the audience. They used the cameras that provided them with videos to decide what really happened. And so that's exactly the scientific approach that the Galileo project is using. And instead of relying on people to tell us what they see, we are using instruments and we analyze the data with the artificial intelligence software so that, there are two advantages to that. One is the computers can go through a much larger set of data than humans can. And they will just look if there is anything anomalous in a huge data set that we collect. And the second is that they do it without any emotional connection or any wishful thinking. And so we want to rely on artificial intelligence for that.
The skies a bit closer to home are full of secrets of their own, including the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 and the 239 people aboard that commercial airliner as it flew above the Indian Ocean. Vincent Line, a man who's been researching the mystery, joined the show to tell us what he's found.
So after the first week after the plane went missing, both the Prime Minister of Australia at that time, Tony Abbott, and also the Malaysian authorities were saying this was a murder-suicide. So they were quite convinced that the plane was intentionally diverted. But when the search was underway, the theory was that nobody was to blame. And why was this dichotomy between, you know, what the Prime Minister and the authorities were saying and what the officials that were investigating the search were saying, that it was nobody to blame?
Richard Godfrey is another independent researcher, and he also believes that pilot involvement is a possible factor in the plane's disappearance. Both Godfrey and Line were quoted in a recent BBC report on the missing plane.
Godfrey noted that the pilot of MH370 had a flight simulator at his home. He had used it to simulate fuel exhaustion over the Indian Ocean.
There were seven satellite signals that Inmarsat discovered, and the critical ones were right at the end. And so the officials interpreted those signals as meaning the plane ran out of fuel. So I think what they reasoned, and I'm trying to guess what they were thinking, because these are very clever people. They're not. I mean, they knew that the plane was diverted. So I think the reasoning went something like this. If the plane ran out of fuel, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter if it was somebody at the helm or no blame. You would still end up in the same location because it ran out of fuel. And Boeing calculated where it would run out of fuel on the 7th hour. So they said, well, okay, let's wait till we find the plane, and then we can sort of say definitely whether it was, you know, somebody to blame or not. So they went with a no-blame theory. But the problem is that interpretation of the 7th hour as running out of fuel was the big problem. The plane didn't actually run out of fuel at the 7th hour. That was a big problem.
in a way, this is like the classic plot twist in any story about a missing plane. They can't find it. They can't find it. They can't find it. They're looking in the wrong place.
An even older mystery resides on the ground in England at the site of Stonehenge. Anthony Clark, a researcher from Curtin University in Australia, was part of a team that unlocked yet another level of this ancient enigma this year. And he joined Something Offbeat to tell us all about it.
The altar stone, I guess, is what we're talking about today, correct?
That's right. My PhD has all been about geochronology. Geochronology is a science of dating geological material. That can be a single crystal to an entire rock. Now, using geochronology, you can address diverse questions in geology, from the age of fossils to the provenance of stones to the age of a volcanic eruption. It's very, very powerful.
In layman's terms, how is this possible? We hear about carbon dating and things, measuring the age of antiquities. Rocks, though, that would seem a whole different game. How do you do that? What do you look for? Certain minerals? What?
It's the same principle as carbon dating, but just on a much longer geological timescale. We use the decay of uranium to lead. Uranium is too big of an element, and it will decay to lead over time. We know the rate at which that decay occurs, and we can measure the ratio of uranium to lead in lots of different kinds of crystals to work out how long that crystal has formed since when it crystallized.
Let's start with the age. Approximately, how old is this stone?
The altar stone is unique at Stonehenge. It is a sandstone, which means it's made up of lots of different grains. You can imagine grains of sand at the beach, squished together, compacted. That means that it really doesn't have one true age. It has lots of different ages of the grains that make it up. The rock itself formed during the Devonian geological period. It formed in a massive lake bed. You could imagine perhaps the Death Valley today for a similar kind of environmental analog. But importantly, the individual grains that make up the altar stone give you that fingerprint of where it formed.
And where did it form? Not nearby, was it?
No. So in general, the rocks in Britain and Ireland, as you go from south to north, become older and more igneous and volcanic. So actually, for such a small country, the bedrock, the geology of Britain is really diverse. And that means that the rocks that form from the erosion of rocks, like sedimentary rocks, can be pinpointed to precise areas in the country. The altar stone has some very ancient grains within it, up to 3 billion years old, which is well over 70% of the age of the Earth. The only place in the UK where you get such old, ancient bedrock is Scotland.
And Stonehenge is nowhere near Scotland.
Stonehenge formed in the Orcadian Basin, of northeast Scotland, which means that it was transported some 300 to 400 miles southwards during the Neolithic.
We want to thank all of our listeners and subscribers and any people checking in for the first time with this episode. If you like what you heard, you can go back and check out the full episodes for more offbeat fun. And come hang out with us next week when we dive into the D.B. Cooper mystery with expert Eric Ulis.